Welcome to the Financial Management Magazine podcast series, a service of the Association of International Certified Professional Accountants. This series features discussions with chartered global management accountants and other experts about the topics, trends and technologies that are transforming the accounting profession.
That's the voice of Samantha White, a contributor to FM Magazine who's based in London. Some of you might be able to place her accent, perhaps down to the quadrant of the city, though Sam has over the years perfected a BBC quality delivery. In this episode of the FM Magazine podcast, we'll hear more from her about learning a version of English that she didn't know existed. She'll be joined by Pam Nelson, a wordsmith from the US who found challenges converting words to British style as a copy editor of publications that include FM. I'm Neil Amato, a senior editor, welcoming you to a talk we're subtitling The Pam and Sam Show. Those two collaborated on some popular quizzes that ran on fmmagazine.com, and today they'll discuss a few words, phrases, and style differences of UK and US English. Let's make a start, shall we? First, welcome to the podcast. I guess we could say Pam is a longtime listener, first-time speaker, and Sam is part of every FM podcast as the voice of the introduction. Glad we get to have you share some knowledge today on what we think is a fun topic that is also a useful one for people working in different parts of the world. We touched on where Sam is from a bit earlier. Let's hear from Pam on her roots and her fascination with all things language.
Thank you, Neil. I am a native of the southeastern United States and specifically western North Carolina. So my accent will definitely sound like a southern U.S. accent to most people. My vocabulary comes partly from what is described as southern Appalachian and coastal southern. So, for instance, I use the word y'all, it's shortened form of you all, to refer to a plural you. And I only use it for more than one you. I'd never use y'all to describe one person, and it actually gets on my nerves when people are faking a southern accent and they use y'all to mean one person. But I sometimes also use the y'all all. So if I'm referring to a big bunch of people, I might say, y'all all better wipe your feet before you come into my clean house. My interest in language is completely part of my personality and part of my background as the daughter of an English teacher, and I've been copy editing for more than 40 years now, so I spent a lot of time thinking about English, and it's been a wonderful intellectual exercise as well as a social exercise to try to understand a little bit more about UK English.
And Sam, I guess now that we've heard from where Pam is from, I guess we can say both of you have, quote, southeast accents at least one time, or maybe yours has disappeared into something you've called estuary English. What exactly is that?
So, yeah, we absolutely both have southeast accents, however different they may be. I'm from southeast of England and also the southeast of London within that. Like many English people of my generation and earlier, I have a telephone voice, or in this case, a microphone voice, which involves speaking properly and enunciating clearly and is more, generally more like received pronunciation or, as you say, a BBC accent. But though I live in London and grew up in a London borough, my natural accent would indeed be described as estuary English. The estuary bit refers to the estuary of the River Thames just to the east of London, between the counties of Kent and Essex. And it's a bit different from Cockney. As I'm sure many listeners will know, the term or label is generally used to refer to true Londoners and their particular accent. To be a Cockney, tradition says you have to be born within the sound of Bow Bells, and the bells in question belong to the Church of St Mary le Bow in the City of London, a short walk away from the SEMA office, in fact. But I think in terms of our listeners, it's quite important to know that even though, you know, the UK would fit into two North Carolinas. It's not a big country in terms of area. The accents vary massively around the country. So, like I say, there's Cockney, there's estuary English right next door. But Manchester accent to the Liverpool accent varies hugely, and that's a distance of 35 to 40 miles. So accent is a big part of our regional identity and a big part of who we are as well.
So just listening to the two of you speak, it's clear there are very different ways of going about communicating in this language we call English. For some, learning to understand an accent can be troublesome, especially if the person you're listening to is a fast talker. But at even a normal pace or an email, there are words that mean different things to different people, accents aside, depending on what side of the Atlantic or the Pacific you call home. Now, Sam, you previously worked as a full-time senior editor for us. At the time, the only magazines and newsletters colleague who wasn't U.S.-based. What did you learn from talking to all these funny-sounding Americans?
Well, first of all, I am a linguist. I'm fascinated by language and idioms, all of that kind of thing. But even still, before I joined the team, I thought I was aware of the differences between American English and British English, like sidewalk for pavement, vacation for holiday, pants for trousers, all of that kind of thing. And that was mostly based on the wealth of American sitcoms and dramas that were on TV over here when I was growing up. But as soon as I started writing for the magazines team and being edited by colleagues in the US, I soon realised that we really are two nations divided by a common language. Seemingly innocuous words began to disappear from my articles or cause massive confusion. And perhaps we should note here that although the publication's house style was to use British English, it was important that the information could be understood by readers around the world so that there was none of that confusion generated by a particular choice of word. For example, I wrote a piece about finance apprenticeships, and I couldn't understand why talking about school leavers was not acceptable. To me, that's a term for anyone who's gone through the secondary school system and is either on their way to work or into higher education. And when we finally had a conversation about it, the editor explained that in the US, that has connotations of someone dropping out and not being particularly successful in their sort of academic experience. So that was one source of confusion. And then the word staff for employees, for example, seems to make American editors recoil, but here it's a perfectly normal, acceptable term. So there's lots of stuff like that, that when it seemed to me straightforward, here, I've written a piece, it's in British English, there you go. It wasn't quite as simple as that.
No, it's not. I mean, even down to things such as a pay rise versus a pay raise. We just don't say pay rise here in the States, but it's far more common, obviously, where you are. So, Pam, you have a great feel for the language, and you mentioned your experience working for U.S. publications. What was it like adding editing responsibilities for FM Magazine, which, as Sam has mentioned, uses British English or a hybrid of it, a kind of global English as its style?
Right. The first thing that people will notice is that spelling is different. We use the O-U-R in British English, where in America or in U.S. English, we would just use O-R, like in the word behavior. But we have, you know, we have computer tools to help us with that. We can use spell check and other ways to deal with that. So the vocabulary differences that Sam was talking about actually are probably a lot harder, because using staff to mean employees sounds odd to us, and it sounds odd to think of it as a plural, because it's in its form it looks singular. But it's, you know, that's something you just have to get used to. But for FM Magazine, we really adopted a kind of hybrid. It's UK in spelling and in, we hope, mostly in vocabulary. But we've kind of made a hybrid as far as the punctuation, the use of quotation marks, and where we put the full stop, which I try to use as often as I can when I'm editing FM Magazine, so I get used to the idea of thinking of it as a full stop rather than, as I would call it in a U.S. publication, a period. Recently, speaking of different languages, different forms, I came across a reference in an article to an electrical outlet. And because I just read somewhere else that in UK English, it would be more likely to be called a PowerPoint. Is that, or some
yeah,
other
socket.
Yeah. So I I looked it up and then changed it in that particular article because I did want to keep our readers. I mean, that's the main point of a style guide is to keep readers from wondering, well, what's that about? You know, to keep readers from being, if we want to give them is the information. We don't want to give them something else to think about. Although if they do think about it, it's fun because they write to us and once in a while and let us know about it.
Is there an example for either one of you where one word that you heard and you were just completely floored by its meaning, either you had no idea what it meant or it meant the exact opposite of what you thought?
I want to say that chuff still confuses me when I hear someone from the UK saying that they're very chuffed about something, meaning that they're happy about it. They have a lot of pride about it, right? So I had to create my own mnemonic for it that chuffed means puffed with pride, so I can remember what that means. Because to me, the first time I hear it, it sounds bad. It sounds like something bad is going on.
That's a good example. If I hear some good news, I might well say I'm chuffed to bits. But the phrase is more commonly used in the north of England.
Ah, that's interesting to know too. That's great.
Sam, do you have one or two? I'm sure you have many.
Yeah, the ones that really stick out for me, one of them was tchotchke. I had absolutely no idea what that meant. apparently, it's like a freebie giveaway thing at a conference or, you know, but I'd never met that word before. And the other one, which I'm still not really sure what it means, is boondoggle.
Which we will get to in just a bit, I guess. It's funny you said about tchotchke. That actually leads me to another thing, because one of the things you sometimes do get at conferences is one of those kind of mesh things that you can put a can of carbonated beverage of your choice in. I don't know if you've ever seen those, but in this part of the world, it's called a koozie. Have you ever even heard of that?
No, I'm imagining it's one of them sort of like a quick thing to keep your can cool. Is that right?
Right.
Exactly.
Like sort of a phone thing. Okay. Yeah,
so we're educating as we go. Well, let's delve into a few words here. How about scheme? What comes to mind when you hear that word? Pam, we'll go with you first.
Well, to me, a scheme sounds like something slightly unsavory, something that is like a fraud scheme. That would be the first thing that would come to mind. And we would think of a scheming person as like, you know, Snidely Whiplash from the Dudley Do-Right cartoons or something.
Yeah, this is an example that came up a few times until I got into my head that Americans have an aversion to the word scheme. In the UK, this is a perfectly neutral word. And what I mean is that there's no judgment attached. It doesn't have sinister connotations. Unless, of course, you're talking about a get-rich-quick scheme. But generally, it's just a project or a system or a program. You might have a housing scheme, a play scheme for kids in the school holidays, that sort of thing.
Yeah, see, a pension scheme to me still sounds like someone's trying to steal something. It just does.
Whereas here, that's, yeah, you know, if you're offered a job, they would talk about one of the benefits being the pension scheme.
Exactly. Now, how about this one? I once had someone in the UK say something to the effect of, "Can you share your diary?" And I don't keep a diary, so I had no idea what they were talking about. And it's a simple word, but it just meant something else.
Well, of course, like it would be great if they were trying to delve into your innermost thoughts that they thought that you kept in a diary. I might well say, let's get it in the diary in terms of let's fix a date to make sure that the meeting or outing that you're discussing will actually happen. Because you know how it is. If you're talking with friends, oh yeah, let's go here, let's do this. And until it is in the diary, it might never happen. So it's, yeah.
So it's kind
just
of like...
Just in terms of fixing a date.
So it's kind of like on the calendar. Share your calendar, share your schedule, but your
availability,
diary.
Exactly.
Now we mentioned boondoggle. I believe Sam once heard that on a phone call with a U.S. colleague, had no idea what it meant. I'll leave it up to you who wants to go first, but I think you both have some boondoggle thoughts.
I did a little bit of looking into boondoggle because it's a funny word and it sounds just cool as all get out. So it's a very American word. It was coined, according to my sources, checking with linguists and lexicographers online, that it was created in the 20th century, about in the 1920s, by a Boy Scout master. And he was using it to describe the little leather braided cords that kids were making, like for lanyards for their... And so it was sort of a make work project. It was a way of keeping the kids busy, and they would produce something that they would, you know, use. It was a camp craft, I guess. So then the word turned up later in newspapers to refer to a kind of a useless or wasteful activity. So a boondoggle we think of as like a make work project, that a public boondoggle would be something that wasted a bunch of money and created some jobs, but really was not very useful for the public, I guess, is one way I think of it.
The closest I can get to, if, as an English equivalent or an English equivalent to that, would be the closest I can come up with would be white elephant or a vanity project in terms of the sort of political money wasting aspect. What you're talking about, the lanyard there, is that the same as a woggle, that what the scouts use to keep their bandana scarf things in place? Can't think what
they're called. Oh, it's a little bit different from that. Yes. This is more like a cord, I guess. But it would be worn on top of their scarves sometimes, over their scarves, but it wouldn't be the little tie clasp woggle thing that holds the scarf together. I mean, and I'm not even sure why the scoutmaster said boondoggle, but I guess it sort of hangs. I don't know. I mean, I'm not exactly sure where it comes from, but it made me think about other words that are coined for one purpose and then get repurposed for something else, and like the which is all what language is all about. I mean, language is all about creating ways to communicate, and then they get changed. And so people complain about U.S. English being invaded by foreign terms or you know, UK terms or even Spanish terms, you know. But that's just part of language change, and we get used to it. So one place where I noticed this phenomenon, was in brand names. So like in the U.S., and this may be true elsewhere too, that a facial tissue, we just call it a Kleenex, which of course is a brand name. And the Kleenex people tried to stop that, I'm sure, for a long time because they wanted to keep their trademark. But for the facial tissue, we call it Kleenex. And one of our UK quizzes that we did for FM Magazine, we talked about Biro, which is a brand name for a ballpoint pen, right? That what we would call just a regular ballpoint pen in British English is often called a biro. So I was really happy one day recently when I saw that show up in a British English TV show called Catastrophe on Amazon. And one of the characters who is British referred to a biro, and it showed up on the caption. And I thought, I know what that means. Thanks to Sam.
I think the company name is Bic. And the guy who invented the ballpoint pen was called Laszlo Biro. So I think that's how I understood it.
Another one that I guess we've thought about is the phrase gen up, for G-E-N-U-P, for people who might not get my accent and might think it's something else. Gen up. What does that mean to each of you?
Well, as I understand it, gen up means to give somebody information, like you're briefing a boss on what you've been doing. Is that right, Sam?
Basically, yeah. It's fairly colloquial. I would gen up on a company or a person before conducting an interview, for example. It sort of means to research, to read up on something. If you give someone the gen, you're basically getting them up to speed, as you say.
So give someone the gen. What does gen stand for in that? Do we have any idea?
This research would not stand up to copy desk scrutiny, I'm sure. Apparently it's from the Second World War, and it's the general information. It's a military thing.
Oh, that makes great sense. That really does stand to reason that it would come from a military background like that.
And so I guess sometimes gen up is confused with another phrase.
Well, when I heard that, and it may be because of the dialectal difference, I heard gin up, G-I-N-U-P, which an editor of mine used to use to describe when she was, generating more something. Like she would say, I've got to gin up some more copy to fill out this column or whatever. And so it was G-I-N. So I think the origin of that is from engine, as in like a cotton gin used to be, came from engine. And so it was a way of generating more stuff. So in a way, gen up and gin up sort of come together that way. But I also, when I was reading about gin up, I read that President Obama had brought it back into practice because into usage, because he used it to mean stirring up, as in ginning up interest in something, which I thought was really interesting that, and it shows also the influence of public speakers and public officials on the language, so that something, I mean, he didn't coin the term, he just was using it, and it kind of brought it back to prominence again.
Yeah, that's not one I've come across. The only connotation that gin, G-I-N, has over here is that it's nearly cocktail hour. That's all an English person would think about if you said to gin up. They would think, yeah, no, we could manage a cocktail at this time, yeah.
Perhaps we talk about that type of gin in another episode or after hours. We'll see. Well, I think to refer back to the President Obama reference, we've sufficiently stirred things up on several language topics here. A reminder that there's a way that you can sort of participate as a listener. We have several ways you can demonstrate your knowledge of the languages. On fm-magazine.com, we have two interactive quizzes. Go to the search bar on the magazine homepage and type words apart, and you can find those quizzes. Or if you prefer the Google route, you can search FM Magazine and words apart, and those two quizzes are the top search items on Google. Thank you so much. The inaugural episode of the Pam and Sam Show. This has been a lot of fun. I think it'll be a lot of fun and also educational and useful for our listeners.
Thanks. And perhaps we can come back to the correct pronunciation of the word root in the next episode.
Excellent foreshadowing of a potential future episode. Thank you, Sam. Thank you, Pam.
Thank you, Neil.
Cheers.
This podcast is designed to provide illustrative information with respect to the subject matter covered and does not represent an official opinion or position of the Association of International Certified Professional Accountants or any of its subsidiaries or affiliates. It is provided with the understanding that the association, its affiliates, and subsidiaries are not engaged in rendering legal, accounting, or other professional services. If such advice or expert assistance is required, the services of a competent professional person should be sought. The association, its subsidiaries, and affiliates make no representations, warranties, or guarantees as to and assume no responsibility for the content or application of the material contained herein, and expressly disclaim all liability for such damages arising out of the use of, reference to, or reliance on such material.